This is an iHeart podcast.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations. Thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The issues. We spend a lot of time talking about the issues, don't we? And they change from day to day, depending on what's in the news. Sometimes immigration's in the news. Sometimes abortion's in the news. Spending, all these things. The news changes, so the issues we're talking about change. But here's what's something we should keep in mind at all times. Something you have to keep in mind. Something I have to keep in mind. We are unique. You're unique. I'm unique. We are political people. We understand that what happens politically is critically important. So we focus on that because it's super important for the direction of the country and where we're going and our kids and our grandkids and all this. So we're political people. But we always have to keep in mind, most people aren't. Most people aren't. They're simply not. If you asked me my biggest issues for the 2024 presidential election, I have two things that are huge for me. And those two things that are huge for me are probably not on the top five, maybe not even the top 10 for the average voter. The two biggest things for me going into the 2024 presidential election: COVID lockdowns, vaccines, tyranny. Did you take part in it? If you did, have you apologized and owned up to it? That's going to be a big one for me. Number two, the FBI, the weaponization of our federal police force. In my opinion, most dangerous thing happening in the country. I will vote based on those two issues. Those are my two main issues going into 2024. Most voters will not. Most voters don't care about those things, or if they do, they care a little. It's not on their mind. You probably have specific things too. They're probably not my two things, but you have two things that I bet you they're not common, because you know what most people vote on. Here's the truth. The economy. There's a million old political statements about it. It's the economy, stupid. It's the economy. Historically, presidents get reelected when there's no economic downturn. If you're elected president, no matter your popularity, what else goes on, if the economy is still chugging along fine when you're up for reelection, you get reelected. That's a rule in this country. Why do you think Democrats went after Donald Trump so hard? Why do you think they took advantage of his naivete when it came to COVID so hard? They did it because they knew they could wreck the economy. The Trump economy was booming. It was going to get him reelected. Boom. They slaughtered him for it. People vote with their wallets. That's just the truth. And the truth is this. Joe Biden being elected when he got elected is just devastating for the country. Now, there's never a good time to have an old, demented fool who can't speak anymore, who's surrounded by card-carrying communists. There's never a good time to have that guy be elected president. It's not like, oh, wow, it's 1954. We're fine with Joe. And no, it would always suck. But, man, we quite literally couldn't afford to have Joe Biden become president of the United States of America, because of the insane COVID response around the world, but also in this country. We simply put ourselves in a real bind. So when 2020 came around, we really could not afford someone like Joe Biden to be installed, elected, whatever you want to call it. We simply couldn't afford it as a nation. And to be honest with you, if you're screaming at the TV right now, they did it to Trump's economy on purpose, you're 100% right, they did. If you're screaming at the TV right now, they used COVID to stop Trump, to get him out of office, you're right, they did. But let's also keep in mind, the insane COVID response in this country began here.
we're announcing new guidelines for every American to follow over the next 15 days. As we combat the virus, each and every one of us has a critical role to play in stopping the spread and transmission of the virus. We did this today. This was done by a lot of very talented people, some of whom are standing with me.
I know that hurts, but that's where the path to destruction began. The very idea that you should look at your economy when a virus comes, for any reason really, but when a virus comes, that you should look at your economy and say, stop. Everyone stop moving. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll press pause. And then whenever we feel like it, we'll unpause it, guys. That is insane. Anybody who's even vaguely familiar with how to run a small mom and pop shop will tell you that is insane to do for a nation, let alone a world. You're putting yourself on the path of destruction. Okay, so 15 days to slow the spread put us on the path to destruction. Then 2 years later, Joe Biden runs for office. Now, he knows that Democrats used COVID to destroy the economy so Donald Trump could get elected. Joe Biden knows all that. The problem is when you run for 2 years on being pro-lockdown, you can't get elected and then say, okay, we're done with the lockdown. So what has the Joe Biden solution been? Lie about it.
Look, the bottom line is we made a lot of progress over the last 20 months to build the economy from the bottom up and the middle out instead of the trickle-down economics that failed us the last 40 years. And we just have to keep going, in my view. What I'm most excited about is people are starting to feel a sense of optimism as they see the impact of the achievements in their own lives. So the economy is up, price inflation is down, real incomes are up. Gas prices are down and need to come down further. Our economy is strong as hell.
Everything's good. Everything's good. Everything's fine. But here's the thing. Back to that talk we were having about you and me and how we're different. You already know the numbers. You know the inflation numbers. You know people are hurting. But people who aren't watching I'm Right Now, they understand the economy's not good too. Why? Because they buy eggs. They buy meat. They buy materials. Have you ever priced construction? Have you priced construction materials recently out there? Things are not good. Things are very, very, very bad. Things are so bad, I can't believe this somehow is out of the news already. You know we already had a recession during Joe Biden's presidency, right? Two straight quarters of economic shrinkage. By definition, that's a recession. Yet they all just decided, the definition changed.
Well, we're certainly in a transition, and we are seeing slowing as we all would have expected. But I think if you look at the full data and the type of data that NBER looks at, virtually nothing signals that this period in the second quarter is recessionary.
President Biden has said we've entered a new phase in our recovery, focused on achieving steady, stable growth without sacrificing the gains of the last 18 months.
Look at it more broadly at the data, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing is that we are in a transition.
It doesn't seem that the U.S. economy is in recession right now.
That doesn't sound like a recession to me. Thank you very much.
Back to the old Biden strategy of just lie. It's actually quite simple when you have no moral compass whatsoever. Whatever something's going wrong, you just lie. So back to the economy that's going bad. It is bad. And if you're paying attention to anything out there right now, any of the economic indicators from the layoffs to the new home builders, the things they're saying to things like that, you understand that we are heading into a very, very dark period economically, which again circles back to Joe Biden and how we just simply could not afford to have this old fool elected, because they are 100% committed to the climate change death cultists whose entire purpose in life is destroying an economy that's already down. Here's our own Treasury Secretary.
I think climate change is an existential threat to our globe and to our future. You can see that countries, it is a long-term risk, but it is becoming notably more severe. I do believe that transition risks are very real as more and more countries adopt frameworks that are meaningful to address climate change, we could see significant changes in asset valuations that pose risk to financial institutions.
That's the Treasury Secretary. Treasury Secretary is sitting around right now, not stressing about your inflation, stressing about that SUV you drive. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. The great Carol Roth is going to break some of this down for us next.
The prices have tripled. It's outrageous.
Even buying the basics is a challenge.
It's ridiculous that we can't go to Sam's and get ketchup because they're out of ketchup for weeks at a time. It took me 2 months to get straws. I couldn't get straws, individually packaged straws. I was like, what do you mean I can't get straws?
She can't even get straws? Tough out there for small business owners. Joining me now, the great Carol Roth, recovering investment banker and author, which is apparently going to be a thing for her now, and I'm glad about that. Carol, okay, break this down for somebody who's not aware. Why are supply chains so screwed up? Why can't a small business owner get ketchup or straws? These are things that have been readily available for my entire 41 years on this planet.
Yes, well, I conceal carry plastic straws in my purse just in case of an emergency. You just put some into, one of those toothbrush holders. My sister taught me that. But it's a challenge, and this goes back a couple of years when they decided it would be a great idea to shut down like a third of the economy and assume that they could just turn it back on as if they were power cycling a modem. And it had long-term ripple effects that by the time Joe Biden got into office, he had a chance to right the ship and turn everything around. And instead, Joe Biden said, nope, I'm just going to double down on really stupid policies. I'm going to just layer some extra crap on there because I don't think the American public is suffering enough. I don't think small businesses are suffering enough. And then I'm going to tell them that this is the greatest economy of all time. That's my plan. I'm Joe Biden and I'm sticking to it.
Carol, small business. What did the government do to crush small business? Because when people think about COVID lockdowns, they think it was bad for business, right? Bad for the economy, whether they support them or didn't support them. And yet they can't quite make sense of why things did just fine at Amazon and Target, but the small mom and pop shops, not so much. Why?
This was the very clever aspect of the way they approached we were all in this together, is that we were not all in this together. The small businesses bore the brunt of the burden of the shutdowns, because who was shut down and who was deemed the evil word essential was not based on data or science. It was based on political clout and connections. So your dog could go get a haircut at a big box retailer that dealt with pets, but you couldn't get your own haircut at a small salon down the street from it. It fundamentally made no sense. So that was sort of the direct issue, is those dollars went from the small businesses to the big businesses. But then the Federal Reserve came in with their intervention in the market. They took interest rates down. They printed money. The government did stimulus. And all of this gave cheap and easy capital to the big companies to be able to come in and compete. While it screwed up the labor force, it screwed up the supply chains, it eventually ended up stoking inflation with the Biden decisions on top of that. And those are all things that if you're a small business that's already been hurt in terms of, you know, having your business shut down and having these labor issues, layering these things on top of it, you don't have the financial wherewithal to be able to withstand them. And, you know, if you look at some of the reports, Alignable says that 40% of the small businesses they surveyed couldn't pay their rent on time and in full in December. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, which follows small businesses, has had 12 months in a row of negative sentiment from small business owners. So this is the backbone of the economy. And by the way, Jesse, people think, you know, when we're talking about small business, that it's small. It before COVID, this was half the economy, you know, half the GDP, about half the jobs, and the biggest job creator. So when we're talking about that, we're not just talking about decentralization and economic freedom, but we're talking about, you know, the economy. And what's going to happen is this great consolidation that we're seeing, where the big just get bigger and more powerful, and the average person ends up owning nothing.
Carol, now why can't they make ends meet? I don't understand. These are business owners. Aren't they all rich?
Yes, the average small business owner is super rich. You know, people go into business because of economic freedom. There's the opportunity potentially to get rich, but obviously of the 32.6 million at last count small businesses that are in this country, a lot of them go into it because they want to be their own boss, or because they have a passion or a calling. There are a lot of objectives that people have, and that's what economic freedom is about. It's not just, you know, becoming a multimillionaire or a billionaire. It's putting out your dream in the way that you want, that meets your objective. And so, you know, if you're an individual business owner, you don't have a huge balance sheet. If you're taking out a loan, you're probably personally guaranteeing it. You might be dipping into your 401k. You might be dipping into your home equity in order to try to make this business go. And it helps everybody. You may have employees. You're providing a product or a service that the people want or need. If you're in a local community and people spend there, 63 cents of every dollar, it's estimated, stays within that community. It supports choice. It supports freedom. It supports decentralization and that pushback against central control. And so it's very, very meaningful in terms of, you know, being able to have the opportunity to own something and to build something and to build wealth and to have those freedom and that choice. And unfortunately, even though it's so important to us, not enough people are really caring about it.
Well, at least the Treasury Secretary is all over it, Carol. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen out there talking about inflation coming down.
I think we'll see a substantial reduction in inflation in the year ahead.
It's going to take a year.
Well, I believe by the end of next year, you will see much lower inflation if there's not an unanticipated shock.
I love that "if" there at the end. Wow, if there's not an unanticipated shock. Carol, it's still at 6.2%, I believe. That doesn't feel like it's coming down. That feels like I'm poorer than I was a year ago.
You are. And let's just talk about Janet Yellen's track record for a second. This is a woman who was head of the Fed and completely missed the opportunity to raise interest rates. She spent a long time campaigning that we talked about a couple years ago, saying there would be no inflation and then it would be transitory. In between her gigs, by the way, she made $7.2 million giving economic speeches, because obviously she's so good at predicting this stuff. And now she's going to tell you that inflation is coming down. What they're not telling you, and we knew this was going to be the ruse, is the rate of growth in inflation is coming down, but the prices are not coming down. So that, you know, 9% year over year that you absorbed last year, plus, you know, the 6% this year, plus the fact that the numbers are fudged, and we know that it's way higher than that anyway. I mean, it's getting, you know, famous rappers like Cardi B concerned when she goes to the grocery store and making videos. If the rappers are feeling the heat of the economy, obviously think about what that's doing to the average American, but they're going to sell it to you. They're going to sell it to you. Everything's great. Everything's coming down. It's all under control. But what it's doing is it's wrecking personal balance sheets. This is going to be a personal recession. People are burning their savings. They're taking on debts. They are killing their wealth to keep up with the stupidity of the Federal Reserve and the government. And then by the time we get to the next boom cycle, they're going to have no wealth left and not be able to take advantage of that. And all of that is going to go to the wealthy and the already well-connected. And this is all part of the plan. And Jesse, not to say that I might be writing a book on this and how you, you know, can fight back about it, and not to say if I were that you would be included in it, but if I were, which is probably not happening, if you go to carolroth.com/nothing, N-O-T-H-I-N-G, you could sign up to find out about it. But this is all very theoretical.
carolroth.com/nothing. Just, hey, nothing. Everybody, there's nothing to see there. Don't go to that link, all right? carolroth.com/nothing. Carol, thank you, ma'am.
It's been nothing, Jesse.
Yes, ma'am, as always. All right, we got more economy talk with the great John Carney next.
I don't think anyone knows whether we're going to have a recession or not. And if we do, whether it's going to be a deep one or not. It's just, it's not knowable.
Really? I'll be interested to hear John Carney's thoughts on that. Joining me now, Breitbart News, finance and economics reporter. John, well, one, we already had a little recession, but two, I see one coming a mile away. You're the economics expert. What do you see?
Yeah, we're going to have a recession. Jay Powell is, I mean, look, I get it. He doesn't want to tell everybody, yes, we're definitely headed for a recession, because when the Federal Reserve says that, it freaks people out. So he wants to downplay the possibility, or I would say the definite probability that we are going to have a recession. So he's downplaying it a bit. He's not being too shy about it. If you listen closely, he's saying, we're probably headed for a recession. Nobody can tell you definitely we are. But look, we just got a whole bunch of economic data in about industrial production. The Philadelphia Fed, the New York Fed, all say that manufacturing is in contraction. The housing market is in contraction. We will have a recession. The only question in my mind is when? Does it happen in the first half of this year, in the middle of the year, or in the back half? I used to be in the back half category. I thought, look, employment is going very strong. I'm now not as certain. I don't think we'll have a recession in the first quarter because employment is still very strong, but we are going to have a recession probably sometime later this year.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Can you expand a little bit on what you said? Manufacturing's in contraction, and you bring up home builders. Now, I was reading some stuff about this morning, but I'd rather you do it in your own words. One, what's happening with home builders? And two, why should we care?
Absolutely. So home building is a major source of jobs in America, and it's also a reflection of what's happening in the rest of the economy. When people feel like they can afford homes, when interest rates aren't too high, then home building usually does very well. And it is not just a driver of jobs to build the homes themselves, which it is, and involves a whole bunch of levels of skill of labor. So you have electricians and plumbers, and then you have people whose job it is to dig the hole, right? And so it is a great source of employment in the United States, but it also creates economic opportunity for a lot of other things. When you build a home, you have to fill it with appliances. So that means people who make appliances are working, people who deliver appliances are working. A lot of times when people buy a brand new home, they also buy a car to go in their brand new garage. That might seem weird, but that there is a correlation between home buying and people buying cars. So there's a whole lot of economic activity associated with home building, and high interest rates kill home buying altogether. And it is really hurting the home builders right now, because when you interest rates are 3%, a lot of people can afford a home. When they're up at 7%, your monthly VIG on that mortgage is a lot higher. And people either need a much smaller home, or a lot of them will just say, you know what, I don't want to pay that much for a house every month. I'm going to hold back.
John, can you help me understand something? And I realize this is a stupid question, but I think it helps people. Let's say my mortgage is $2,000 a month when I'm paying 3%, all right?
Right.
So it goes to 7%. What's my mortgage become, roughly? I know this is going rough. I'm asking you to do this live.
It's going to double. I mean, because remember, unless you have some sort of funky mortgage, which I will advise everybody, don't get one of these mortgages where you're not actually paying some of the principal and some of the interest every month. When the interest rate goes up, the interest rate portion of your monthly payment goes up. And so, and while the principal might stay the same, so it doesn't quite double, but it comes very close to the interest rate portion does, you know, double. And so you're paying a lot more. Right now, some people are in a position where they own a home. They might have retired, their kids might have grown up, and they're thinking of moving into a smaller home. But if they have a 3% mortgage, it might cost them more to move into the smaller home than staying in the big home. And what does that do? It paralyzes the market, because people who would be sellers of, say, you know, bigger family homes aren't selling to people who want those homes. That drives prices up, which makes homes even less affordable. And that's basically the situation we're in right now.
Good grief. Okay, sorry about all the nerdy details, but I find this stuff fascinating. Manufacturing contracting. Now,
right,
that can't all be tied to home builders. Why is manufacturing contracting?
Right. So a couple reasons. One, interest rates are high, and that has made people they have to pay more for mortgages when they have them. So it is not unrelated to housing. But also, there's been a huge shift in buying that's been going on for a while now, where we bought a lot of goods during the pandemic. When we were locked in our homes, people bought, you know, exercise bikes, people, you know, got new, you know, redid their kitchen. A lot of manufactured goods were in high demand during the pandemic and the reopening. We're now shifting back to a kind of more normal spending pattern. And one of the things that means is that there is just a lower demand for manufactured goods, both in the United States and around the world. And so so we're seeing both in November and December, manufacturing output shrank in the United States, meaning factories in the U.S. produced fewer manufactured goods. And in certain areas like the Philadelphia area, which includes Delaware, part of West Virginia, part of New Jersey and part of Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia Fed says manufacturing in that area has been in contraction for 7 months. So we are really seeing manufacturing in the United States shrink. And the question is, you know, my friend Larry Kudlow, who works for another network, likes to say, if you're not making stuff, you can't be consuming stuff. So this manufacturing contraction means that eventually we're going to have to start to pull back on consumer spending, and probably employment's going to have to fall as well.
Dang. All right. Now, I want to talk about BlackRock and ESG and things like that for a moment, because Larry Fink right now is starting to become, I'm grateful for this, a more public figure. People are waking up slowly to all this. Well, anyway, here's Larry Fink.
How much has the political backlash, thank you, to ESG investing had on you and BlackRock?
I'm taking this very seriously. We are trying to address the misconceptions. It's hard because it's not business anymore. They're doing it in a personal way. And in the first time in my professional career, attacks are now personal. They're trying to demonize issues.
Oh. If we personally attack that guy who's trying to destroy our way of life. Anyway, John, could you please explain what ESG is and what's BlackRock? I've never heard of these guys.
Sure. BlackRock is the biggest asset manager in the world. They manage trillions of dollars of retirement assets for public pension funds, like a lot of teachers' funds, state pension funds give money to BlackRock. A lot of state governments have accounts with BlackRock where they have some money and they're trying to earn some interest on it. So BlackRock is a giant in the investing world. If you look at the largest holders of a lot of stock, you'll see that it's BlackRock or a fund managed by BlackRock that is the biggest holder of many of the Fortune 500 companies. So BlackRock got really enthusiastic about a style of investing known as ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and governance. What this meant was The governance part was, you know, there are certain things that certain people think are good governance, you know, allowing shareholders a good way to vote on issues, not having dual class stocks. That's okay. That's been around for a long time, worried about governance. The social aspect is new. And really, in the last decade, I'd say the environmental aspect has almost come to dominate ESG investing. And what it is basically pushing a left-wing climate change agenda on corporate America, trying to pressure corporate America, because remember, BlackRock is the biggest shareholder. So when BlackRock says, we want you to be carbon neutral, companies say, yes, sir, right? They jump to it because they don't want BlackRock either selling shares of their company or voting on proxies against the board of directors of a company. So this has become a very big thing. It's one of the reasons why investment in energy infrastructure, and particularly oil and gas extraction in the U.S., has been so low, because so much money has poured into ESG strategies that try to avoid investing in fossil fuels. So basically what he's saying is, look, I was part of the war on fossil fuels, and I can't believe people have the temerity to get angry at me. He has been pushing this for years, and I think he is trying to back off. Maybe one, because it actually ended up with a lot worse effects than he thought it would. And then I think he's also worried about the backlash.
John Carney, go read his stuff. I appreciate you, John.
Thanks for having me.
All right. The great Dave Bratt joins us next. I don't know what that means. Joining me now, my friend Dave Bratt, former congressman, current dean of business at the great Liberty University. Dave, I went to community college. There was a lot of green and a lot of red. Everything started going up this way in the 1900s. What am I looking at, Dave? That didn't look like crayons to me. I don't understand all this.
Yeah, I cannot recommend this site. It's called Gapminder, G-A-P. All the homeschool parents, educators, kids that care about economics, go Google this thing. You can have all the countries. I see your crew got advanced and just highlighted the U.S. and China. So China's the red, U.S. is the green. The significance of this is economic growth in the modern world started at 1800. That in itself is a big deal. So no economic growth prior to that. Everybody on Earth, no matter what your culture, country, economic system, made $1,000 a year to live on, period. Okay, then at 1800, you start getting Adam Smith, free markets, countries choose the free market system. That's the main ingredient. If you choose, there's always been markets, right? The Hebrew Bible's got markets, the Greek Agora was a market, but that doesn't get you major economic growth. You have to choose to use the free market system. So you see right there again, over there, 1930, right? The U.S. is moving. We're getting richer. The further to the right you go, the richer you are. So we end up, you know, at $60,000 per capita. But the story on this thing, and keep your eye on the ball, and the only ball to watch, even if all the other 200 countries are on here, is that red ball right there, China. The higher you get is your life expectancy, which just comes straight off of economic growth. If you grow economically, you live longer. And you get all the other benefits. You get human rights and calorie intake and years of education and all that. And so the point of this is, if anybody thinks the Russia-Ukraine war is a major piece of policy you ought to be paying attention to. This video shows you very clearly there's Russia is nowhere near the China piece. And then if you add, I'll just go real quick, a couple other little variables. One is the percentage of industrialization. You'll see that China is cleaning our clocks on that. You can fiddle with that over on the vertical axis and change it from population or age expectancy for life expectancy. You can change it to percentage of industrialization. You'll see the U.S. has gone down lately. All of Europe has crashed, and China, of course, is going up. Same thing with the percent of capital investment, which is the number one driver of economic growth. And you'll see China way up, doing the right thing. The U.S. Going down. Europe, yellow countries, if you click on all the countries there. And that's the way it comes loaded. They're in decline. And I don't know if you guys got the second graph I sent over with a purple line at the top, the chart that's got some environmental economic stuff on there. If they have that, they can pop that up. But right now, Davos is going on, and they're all selling the green economy. There's another chart that shows the green economy in Europe has overtaken the size of the overall economy in the European countries. That's the social choice they've made. So they haven't chosen the free market system. And then, of course, the irony of ironies is the poor countries can't afford to be green. So the only countries that matter for the environment are China and South America, et cetera, right? If you give them a choice between subsistence food, right, like feeding your kids so they don't die, so they have basic nutrition, or being green, let me tell you what button they're going to push when they vote. And so all the Davos folks are over there, and it takes about an eighth grade education to figure this stuff out, right? On the environment, if you don't get China to cooperate, which they won't because they need to survive, that ain't going to happen. So that it just almost proves the Davos green piece is a ruse for them to gain huge wealth. And so the I think most people that are following your show also know the Russia-Ukraine piece. The Ukraine has been used as a monetary dumping ground to hide money. And the proof of that is they won't audit the $100 billion that U.S. taxpayers have paid for that war, while the Europeans in their backyard have spent barely anything on that war. So there's a brief summary, and you let me have it, what I did not explain properly.
No, that's you explained it pretty well. Dave, I do have to ask, as we watch that eye-popping chart and all of a sudden the red starts to jet to the right really hard.
Right.
Why? What happened? Did they discover a big pot of gold over there or something?
Yeah. Well, that's what I said. The reason they didn't take off in 1800 is because they didn't choose the free market system. It's a system you have to choose that Adam Smith spelled out. We've always had smart people. The Chinese are plenty smart. We've always had trade, shipping, all that, inventions. But that does not cause economic growth. So what happened in 1970, the Chinese finally chose the free market system. Some market reforms, they allowed it. The Russians opened up politically. The Chinese were wiser communists. They chose to open up economically the markets and stayed totalitarian on the political front. Well, that worked. That'll work in the short run, as Japan taught us as well. Eventually, they run out of steam. The reason it's going to end is Xi Jinping, about 2 months ago now, they had the 20th CCP meetings. He made three basic decisions. Number one, they're full-on Marxist-Leninist, period. Ideology will drive everything. Two, no more market reforms. There's your big hint as to what's going to happen to China in the next decade. And then three, they've moved to a war footing. They got rid of all Chinese lingo, which was good, right? There's some Buddhist wisdom that used to be in their platform and some Confucian lingo about peace and harmony and reason and living together. They got rid of all that and moved toward a war footing language of tension. We will be at tension with the world and get ready for struggle sessions. So China had the secret formula. They were moving, but now they're going to move in reverse, is my forecast.
Why? Why go in reverse? It's working. Yep. The chart is going to the right. Why are you going in reverse?
Xi Jinping probably thinks they got some hard times coming, right? Their people are finally getting the internet. They can see what's going on. The COVID crisis, he knew he had to lock everybody down. You're seeing mini revolutions across China now. There's a Christian underground church that's emerging. Everyone has cell phones. They can talk to each other. And so, and the U.S. is already starting to move against China. You can see he knew it was coming. Even China, even Biden went harder on China than Trump did. And so we're starting to make some moves. So he's going to try to go internal and develop his own self-sufficient, consumer-driven, demand-driven economy. In the past, it's been all supply side, which really worked quite well for them. Supply side business investment and then trade and stealing all of our ideas and patents, and everybody knows that stuff. And so he, I think he knows that game is probably coming to an end. So he's got to get self-sufficient in energy. That's why he's buddying up with Russia right now. And so that's a short, sweet answer, I hope.
Gosh. Tough times coming. Dave Bratt, you're the best, man. I appreciate you.
Love it. Thanks, Jesse. Great show.
Always get smarter when Dave joins us. You know what else we get smarter with? Me. And my final thoughts, they're next. Let's keep in mind that we are a tiny percent. You, me, we're the one percenters. We're the tip of the spear or something like that, whatever you want to call us. The economy is what so many Americans vote on. It's what so many Americans focus on. They focus on themselves, their mortgage, their wife, their kids, their husband, their mom, their vacation, their clothes. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's just real life. That's how normal people vote. They vote on the food on the table. And it's really bad right now. And it's getting worse. Maybe for final thoughts, maybe our final thoughts should be this. Maybe we should have that conversation with our normal neighbor, who's not really political, who's having some struggles, and appropriately, whenever we can fit it in, when it's appropriate, don't be out of line, maybe let them know why things are so bad, huh? All right, we'll do it again.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart Podcast.